Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And the Obama campaign and the McCain campaign's rolling along. Increasing evidence that there may have been some connection between Karl Rove's international travels over the last couple of weeks and the decision by Georgian President Saakashvili to invade the South Ossetia. And anyhow, we'll get into that in a little bit. Other issues that are coming up in the presidential election, of course, abortion is always a big one, and Planned Parenthood, on the let's kick them around end of this. And not just abortion, even the Bush administration is proposing new rules that would define contraception as abortion, and that's getting pretty strange. And our local Planned Parenthood chapter, actually here in the Willamette Valley, it's the Planned Parenthood Columbia Willamette, PPCW, PCCW.org is their website, is coming under attack from a group in Arlington, Virginia, Students for Life of America, their website, studentsforforlife.org. And we have on the line with us, is it Kristan Hawkins?
Yes, that's correct. Thank you.
Kristan. Kristan, welcome to the show. You object, there, well, let's set this up. There's a series of what the local Planned Parenthood suggests is funny videos up designed to reach out to people in their late teens and early 20s to talk in a fairly candid way about issues that are apparently not being talked about, because we're seeing an increase in sexually transmitted diseases here in Oregon. And it's not just here, but looking at the statistics around here, 1 in 14 girls now has a sexually transmitted disease. Here in Oregon, the teen pregnancy rate is rising. There's been a real attack, a sustained 30-year attack on sex education in our public schools, and Planned Parenthood is pushing back. You are offended by this.
Well, I'm offended by their Take Care Down There .org website. This website they released, it has skits on it, satirical skits. One of the skits is called I Didn't Spew. Two male teenagers actually engaging in oral sex in the skit. The male teenager who's pleasuring his partner stands up, wipes his mouth, and a creepy guidance counselor guy comes in the background and encourages them to use condoms. Everyone I've seen watch the video was totally shocked by the video itself, that it was on the internet, that young children can access it at any time.
Let's make it clear. There's no depiction of oral sex in this video. That's all off screen, and in fact, it's not actually happening. And the point was to shock people. The point was to say, there are people who are having oral sex who think that if a man doesn't have an orgasm, that and you have oral sex, and oral sex, by the way, along with anal sex, is increasing dramatically among kids and teenagers, in part because of the failure of sex education, because they think that there's no way to get a sexually transmitted disease or to get pregnant if it's not just normal vaginal sex, and so you've got these kinds of sex increasing. They wanted to get people's attention with this. I think this is a good thing.
But isn't that Planned Parenthood's job? They've been receiving, they get over $300 million from taxpayers every year to educate teens.
You're talking about Planned Parenthood National. This is a local Planned Parenthood office that put this website up.
Planned Parenthood Columbia Williamette does receive federal funds. They receive Title 10 federal taxpayer dollars.
Sure. And those federal funds allow them to provide sex education services, sexually transmitted disease testing, and contraception, annual exams, general family planning and health and sex sexual health care, safer sex counseling to over 60,000 people, mostly women, men, and teens in their 11 health care centers here. And in fact, it doesn't even cover the cost of that. They have to get private donations just for the core services that they're providing.
But yet you're saying they're failing at this. This is something that Planned Parenthood has been for years saying, this is why we need a federally funded sex education in high schools. This is why we need to tell 13 and 14-year-olds about oral sex, about anal sex.
Absolutely, because they're having it right now, and they're transmitting god-awful diseases to each other because they don't understand what they're doing.
But they're failing. So you're telling me they are failing, correct?
What I'm telling you is that when kids don't understand sex and they participate in it anyway, that they do it in ways that are extremely dangerous to them. If we're going to inform children about how, and actually this isn't even targeted at children, but as you say, it's on the web, anybody can see it. But if you're going to inform people about, we inform people about everything from gun safety and how to safely kill people or avoid being killed. Why don't we inform people about how to avoid getting AIDS if you're going to have sex? Or the more common sexually transmitted disease. Literally one in four teenage girls in the United States right now has a sexually transmitted disease. You can't tell me that that's not the result of the decades of the war on sex education that you folks have been mounting.
The war on sex education?
Yeah.
Oh, that's outrageous. There just came out a report from HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, this June, stating that sex education, comprehensive sex education, something you're advocating for, had no effect in keeping kids from having sex and preventing diseases. So I don't understand how we're saying that this comprehensive sex education.
I don't believe it.
Oh, okay. Well, you cannot believe
it. Are you seriously trying to tell me that if you educate somebody about how to avoid getting a disease, that they're going to go ahead and get a disease?
Look, my point here is that this is government-funded, that my taxpayer dollars are paying for this.
The war in Iraq is taxpayer-funded, Kristen, also, and I object to the war in Iraq.
Well, so do a lot of people, sir. A lot of people affect.
So just because it's taxpayer-funded.
A lot of my members object to the war in Iraq. I'm not talking about the war in Iraq. And you have every right to protest the war in Iraq if you object to that.
And you have every right to protest this.
I'm protesting the fact that Planned Parenthood is using my taxpayers' dollars to have obscene material on the internet where parents can't even control the content that their kids are seeing. Isn't the parents' job to teach children about sex education? Don't they have some say in what their children see over the internet? You can't ban this Planned Parenthood site. It doesn't come up when you have the software to ban the pornographic websites, but it's borderline pornographic. That's my point. This is taxpayer-funded money, and there is no reason why Planned Parenthood should be using our money to produce this website.
I think what they're doing is a marvelous thing. I think that they are informing teenagers about the dangers of unprotected sex and nobody else. And because so many of our sex education programs around the country are now abstinence-only based and they won't actually talk about sex, you've got a lot of uninformed kids. And that's a disaster. It's a disaster waiting to happen.
That's not true. Abstinence education obviously talks about sex. They tell the children why having sex is risky behavior and what the consequences of having sex are. It's not that they don't talk about sex and sex doesn't exist.
And the fact of the matter is that that doesn't decrease sexual behavior either.
Well, obviously comprehensive sex ed isn't decreasing it either.
So if neither one of them are decreasing sex, let's help our kids know how to have safe sex. If teenagers are going to be having sex, let's make sure that they're not transmitting diseases to each
other. Why didn't the Planned Parenthood website, why didn't it have a video explaining, here are the reasons why you should use a condom, here are the reasons, this is what can happen if you don't use a condom. Why did they have to do it in this weird kind of goofy setup where,
because that's
when
how you talk
them,
to
they
kids.
Said aim for late teens and college students, I looked at it and was like, this is the most ridiculous thing I've ever seen. I'm in my 20s. I've got college students here interning. It obviously had no impact on them, and they're getting my money to do this.
Yeah, well, I guess we're respectfully disagreeing. By the way, we're talking to Kristan Hawkins, the executive director of Students for Life, studentsforlife.org, an organization out of Virginia. She's upset about the what's the website? I'm sorry, I don't have it.
It's called takecaredownthere.org.
Takecaredownthere.org website, which has been put up by the Planned Parenthood of Columbia and Willamette here in Oregon, ppcw.org. And bottom line, you're calling as part of this. Number one, I'm assuming Students for Life is trying to become a larger organization. I'd say, you know, in a way that you're trying to hook yourself to this as a PR stunt. But in that context, you're calling for the defunding of Planned Parenthood. Is that it? No more federal funds?
Yes, we've been working on this all summer. We've had stories in the Washington Post, the Washington Times, major cable news networks about this. We've been working with African American pastors and student leaders calling Congress to investigate and defund Planned Parenthood. We already know Planned Parenthood has racist charges out against it. It's fighting statutory rape cases in Ohio. It's under investigation for doing illegal late-term abortions.
Would you rather have sex education federally funded in our public schools?
Excuse me?
Would you rather have this kind of sex education informing teenagers and people in their young, in their early 20s about how to have safe sex in our schools? Or do you just simply not want the discussion to be had at all?
I don't want the discussion being had with my money. That's the point.
Okay. So perhaps Planned Parenthood should think about putting this behind a firewall and funding this entirely with donations, because I know that they're certainly getting donations.
If this was donation funded, I wouldn't have had a problem with it.
That would have satisfied you. That's interesting.
Yep, because I can choose not to give them money.
Okay. Kristan Hawkins, studentsforlife.org, the website, and ppcw.org. And again, the website you're objecting to, Kristan?
Is takecaredownthere.org.
Takecaredownthere.org. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, let's see. In today's Financial Times, just to wrap that up, I am very, very, speaking as a parent and as a fellow member of the human race, you know, why is it that we can talk about murder, we can talk, something that none of us ever do, or very, you know, those few among us who do are considered, you know, psychopaths or something. Why is it that we can talk about murder? We can talk about, you know, let's teach gun safety or whatever, but we can't talk about sex, something that most everybody does at some point. And as a consequence of this, I mean, literally one in four teenage girls having a sexually transmitted disease in the United States right now, you don't see these high levels of teen pregnancy and sexually transmitted diseases in European countries where kids are taught sex ed in the schools. You just don't see it. Where the discussion is open and candid, it doesn't happen. Instead, we've got it here because we've got a whole lot of people who are just, you know, terrified to talk about this stuff. And it's just, it's wrong. Robert Scheer, by the way, yesterday in Truth Dig, Randy Shuneman, Scheer asking the question, is it possible that this time the October surprise was tried in August and that the garbage issue of brave little Georgia struggling for its survival? Let's remember, Georgia invaded first. It was Georgia that invaded South Celeste, it was Georgia that invaded South Ossetia, and the governor Dmitry Medvedev is you know pointing this out, but Shakavili is in fact we had been promoting Shakavili you know, through the last elections. He's been the and he had hired Shuneman, Randy Shuneman, this guy who is the, you know, the foreign policy advisor for John McCain. His main income comes from Georgia. And but consider some of his previous things. This, again, from Robert Scheer's piece. Consider the role of one Randy Shuneman, for 4 years a paid lobbyist for the Georgian government, who ended his official lobbying connection only in March, months after he became Republican presidential candidate John McCain's senior foreign policy advisor. Previously, Shuneman had been best known as one of the neoconservatives who engineered the war in Iraq when he was director of the Project for a New American Century. It was Shuneman who, after working on the McCain 2000 presidential campaign, headed the Committee for the Liberation of Iraq, which championed the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And today, in the Financial Times, Anatole Levin is writing, on the other hand, the Bush administration, with the full support of the U.S. Congress, armed, trained, and overwhelmingly financed the Georgian military. It did this although the dangers of war involving these forces were obvious, and after the Georgian government had told its own people that those forces were intended for the recovery of Abkhazia and South Ossetia. The Bush administration, backed by John McCain, also adopted a highly uncritical attitude to both the undemocratic and chauvinistic aspects of the Saakashvili administration. And then they go on to point out, according to European officials, the Bush administration even put heavy pressure on U.S. and international monitoring groups not to condemn flagrant abuses by Mr. Saakashvili's supporters during the last Georgian elections. And the U.S. is pushing for them to be a NATO member. This is so much looking like a provocation set up by a senior guy in the John McCain camp to change the topic away from Iraq. That topic was not doing well for John McCain. Even when he could get people to say, oh, the surge is wonderful, that topic was not doing well for John McCain. The economy, that topic doesn't do well for John McCain. And the Obama folks were sitting around going, where's he going to go? What else has he got? He's got the economy, he's got Iraq. What's he going to do? Talk about privatizing Social Security? Today's the 73rd anniversary of it. Sure, he's got nothing. And they're sitting there very, very confident going, he's got nothing. Well, now he's got something. Now he gets to be Ronald Reagan. Now he gets to be the Cold Warrior. Now he gets to call on the president of Russia to tear down that wall or to move those troops out. Today we're all Georgians, just like Jack Kennedy. Ich bin ein Berliner. I believe this is Republican campaign strategy. Where was Karl Rove when he was in that part of the world, when he was out of the country, when he was supposed to be testifying before Congress? In my opinion, what we're seeing here, in addition to the culture wars, in addition to the let's not have sex ad, in addition to all of that, what we're seeing is the revival of the Cold War because they think they can win that fight.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call us at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. Strange stuff going on out there. Amir Khan. This is a guy. This is a born and bred American, 32-year-old IT specialist out of Fresno, California. Literally your average American, except that his name is the same as a couple of terrorists. Khan, a U.S. citizen, often travels on business. He figures he's spent a total of 20 hours under interrogation as he goes through airports. His wife has also been questioned. He says the feds have investigated his bank account, his credit card information. On several occasions, he's been ordered to log onto his laptop so custom agents can search his records. He says, I love America, but I feel humiliated and degraded. I was told, we'll be doing this to you for the rest of your life. I've had enough. Why don't they go after the real criminals? Good idea. Amir Khan. Here's another name, two other names to think about. Yusuf al-Khalid and Abed al-Khalid. These are the 7 and 9-year-old children of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's kids. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the guy who it is alleged is the mastermind of 9/11, he was captured by the CIA, and apparently his children, well, not apparently, I mean, it's been reported that his children were also captured by the CIA at the age of 7 and 9. They were tortured using insects and food deprivation. They were used to extract confessions from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed himself, and they are still disappeared. The 9-year-old would now be 16, and would now be 15, excuse me, and the 7-year-old would now be, what, 13? Where are these kids? Where are these children? It's like the CIA still got them. I mean, I don't believe that they have been charged with any crime other than having a notorious father. Apparently that's a crime these days. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Sex education, John McCain, South Ossetia, whatever you want. Norman in Washington, D.C. Hey, Norman, what's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good.
I'm about a late 20-year-old guy. Mm-hmm. And when I was in high school, to be honest with you, you know, I was, not to be graphic, but I was pretty sexually active, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
And I look back on those times, and I'm married now. I've been married for about 5 or 6 years. But I look back on those times, and the only thing that saved me is that I knew here, we were being somewhat educated on it. My mom was educating me on it, and you could go to your guidance counselor and get condoms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how long we're going to allow people to die for a 50-cent condom.
Yeah,
I mean, how long? I mean, this is just ridiculous.
I agree. You know, the fastest growing population now with AIDS in the United States is young African American.
Right, right, right. And I look back and I think, you know, I was saved by that, and I think it's just a tragedy. Sometimes I believe that people like the Young Ladies Organization, because anything you said, she was not listening to that. The only thing she could say is her tax money. Well, my tax money is being paid for, and I think more should be done for it. And I think sometimes they want to keep the problem going so they can say, look, this is what happens to you when you have sex. You get diseases, you have kids you don't want. Because they don't, they, I
yeah, it's sort of like the conservative philosophy of break government and then point to it and say, see, it's broken. We should privatize it. Let's just turn it over to Halliburton.
Hey,
Norman.
You got it, Tom.
Yeah, Norman, thanks a lot. You know, well said. David in Portland. Hey, David.
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Just great, but I'll get better. How about you?
Your comments about the sex education and that woman's group, that was right on. One thing that I noticed, and I hear a lot from people, is this idea that somehow they're going to control their children. And I mean, the presence of a website somehow causes people to think that they're going to lose control of their children.
Yeah, and this is a website, actually, that says, you know, that cleans up myths, like the myth that if you have oral sex and there's no orgasm involved, then there's no possibility of transmitting a disease. And that's the message. And I think sometimes it takes humor or maybe a little bit of shock. And there's a little bit of both in this, although this is not graphic. And frankly, I didn't find it creepy. I thought it was funny. But the point is
this is the 21st century.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a parent like you. I'm a parent. And my kids are all grown now. And if I was under the impression at one point in time that somehow I was going to control what my kids are able to see on the Internet, I mean, that's like impossible.
Yeah, or what they're going to do when they're not around us. Good point, David. Thank you. Richard in North Carolina. Hey, Richard.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing?
Just fine. What's up?
All I can say is PNAC, PNAC, PNAC. People, everybody listening needs to go PNAC and look.
As in Project for a New American Century. We're seeing it all over again. These guys, what McCain is trying to do, and Randy Schoeneman, or however he pronounces his name, Schoeneman, I guess, is trying to do, and frankly, I think the Bush administration is trying to do, is change the dialogue for this election away from Iraq, because that's a loser for the Republicans, away from the economy, because that's a loser for the Republicans, and two, we're going to have a war against Russia, and who's been fighting Russia for 71 years? John McCain.
Absolutely. You know, it wasn't even the reason I called, because I started out telling the person that screens your calls that I'm a health education teacher in Western North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And in our community, they went ahead, there were a few women that got kind of all up in it and wanted to make sure that parents were teaching their children about sex and that the school system wasn't doing it, which is as absurd as it gets.
Yeah, well, it's tragic. I mean, certainly in a perfect world, parents would be doing sex ed.
Well,
but,
I mean,
but a lot of parents even are not well informed.
I mean, assuming that they're well informed, and let's face it, it is an uncomfortable subject for some people. I mean, bottom line, we are sexual creatures. We are sexual beings.
Right. That's my point. I don't even think we're violent beings. I mean, we talk about violence. We show movies with murder and killing in them all the time. You know, on TV, we're showing, and Richard, thank you for your comment. I find particularly amazing. We have been watching on television over the last week, we have been watching graphic images of dead people in the streets and bombing of apartment buildings and bodies of soldiers when we're told that they're the victims of Russians. But we can't see the same thing in Iraq. We can't see the civilians who are the casualties of our own bombing. We can't see our own soldiers coming back in coffin. No, that's verboten. You'll never see that on American TV. But in any case, it's fine to see dead bodies if it's the bad guys, but which is something that most of us are, you know, God willing, are never going to experience. You know, the killing and war and things like this. And yet, most all of us do, sex is, well, we can't talk about that. Barbara in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Barbara.
Hey, how you doing?
Just great.
Good. I went right after you had that segment with that girl about Take Care Down There, and I watched all of the videos. Right, sorry. And I watched the videos, especially the one specifically that she was talking about, and I am stunned how anyone could be offended by it.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I mean, I looked at it. I'm actually going to have my son look at those videos because they're concise, they're to the point, they're non-threatening,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's a marvelous tool to bust some of those myths that kids are suffering under, and you know, STDs are running rampant,
right,
in our kids, the population of high schoolers,
yep,
and younger.
Oh, and younger. Yeah, one of the things that they found is that in the United States right now, we have elementary school kids showing up with STDs, and one of the real flip out, we had an expert on this about 6 to 8 months ago, maybe it was a year ago on this show, one of the real amazing things was that they were finding all these anal STDs, and they couldn't, you know, what's going on? What they found out was that these kids thought that if intercourse was not vaginal, that there was no possibility of transmitting diseases. And it's like, what?
It's all
this mythology, you know?
It's crazy and strange, and you know, if you swallow Clorox after having sex, that'll prevent you,
right,
from getting pregnant. I mean,
yeah,
all of this stuff is just insane, and we're doing very serious damage to our children,
yeah,
by not allowing them to be educated responsibly.
Well
and
said.
Clearly, the parents aren't doing their job.
No, and they never have and they never will. I mean, some parents are going to do a great job, and in that case, this is all redundant. And their kids are not going to be offended by this. And
right,
and for those parents who are not doing a good job of sex ed with their kids, we need this kind of thing.
I tip my hat to
Planned Parenthood.
And, yep,
and Barbara, thank you very much for your comments. Bobby in Indiana. Hey, Bobby.
Hi, Tom. How are you? I love the show.
Thank you.
I'm calling about the gentleman you were talking about a little bit ago, that is constantly searched at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his statement amazed me because he said that I love America, but, you know, he's insulted by this. And I thought it's amazing he can continue to love America because it's horribly insulting. And I'm so ashamed to know that I have a government that would take two little girls and put them and torture them.
They were actually little boys, but yeah.
Little boys.
Same thing.
And it's all part of this bigger, I mean, we have Osama bin Laden's driver put away, for heaven's sakes. I mean, are we going to go after everybody that drove everyone around?
Yeah. I know. And in fact, actually, you know, Osama bin Laden's driver was acquitted of having anything to do with terrorism. He was convicted of a very minor charge. He was given 5.5 years, and he's already been in prison for 5 years. In 6 months, he's going to be eligible to get out. And the Bush administration says, you know, when under the court system, under their own kangaroo court system, he's eligible to get out. They probably won't let him out. They'll just declare him an enemy combatant and keep him for the rest of his life. I mean, this is how crazy it is. We've kidnapped children and we're not revealing, you know, where we've got them locked up. We tortured them. We used them to torture their father. I mean, our government, thank you, Bobby, our government has become criminally insane. These guys from John Yoo to Bush to Cheney to the whole bunch of them, in my opinion, are criminally insane. 45 minutes past the hour.
Watch live video of the Tom Hartman program at hartmanradio.com.
Someday I hope you get the chance to live like you would die. Yeah. Like tomorrow.
9.5 minutes past the hour. Oh, what a great bumper. Two of our kids have their birthdays right around this time. One was a week and a half ago. The other will be in a week or three. And we gave them as their birthday gift these two. Of our three, skydiving trip. And they went skydiving last weekend. We went out and watched them jump out of an airplane. And, which was a gas, something that I did back when I was 19 years old, three times and broke my back the third time. That's a whole nother story. But, the kids just did it great. But it reminded me, I was speaking at an Oklahoma conference, University of Oklahoma conference. I think it was actually in Tucson. A Native American conference. There's about 450 Native Americans there, and Louise and I and one of our kids. We were the only non-Native Americans, as far as I know, at the conference. And there was a guy that I met there, Ari Mayan, just a really neat guy. I've written about him in one of my books, in fact, I think in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And at that particular time, I'm a private pilot, and I know everything that can go wrong in an airplane. And I'd been in a 737. This was, as I said, a couple decades ago. And I'd been in a 737 that was flying out of New York in a thunderstorm, which they don't do anymore, but they used to do back, you know, with some regularities, fly through thunderstorms. And we got hit by lightning as we were climbing out, and the engines hesitated, and the plane went dark and started to pitch out of the sky, and the person across the aisle from me reached over and grabbed my arm, and people, you know, I mean, we all thought we were going to die. And had an almost similar experience flying into the Philippines in Typhoon Stephen in a 747, Philippine Airlines 747. The plane was so violently pitching around and the flexing so hard that the overhead compartments were popping open and luggage was flying around. And I just gotten to the point where it took a couple of drinks to get me on an airplane. And I mentioned this to Ari and what was becoming almost a fear of flying. And he said, well, that, you know, you've got to just, you know, clean up your life. You got to reach a point where you can say today's a good day to die and it doesn't matter. So I called up pretty much everybody I knew that I felt like I had, you know, that I owed an apology to. In fact, I sent a note to my publisher, one of my publishers, Tim Underwood, Underwood Books, who published my ADD books, and you know, just trying to clean up an old disagreement. And Tim sent me back and, are you in a 12-step program or something? I was like, you know, that's the fifth step. And I'm like, no, I didn't know that. So anyhow, I finally went out and I saw Ari again. I was out in New Mexico, and he had given me a spirit name, and there was this whole ceremony that a friend of ours, Michael Hutchison, had broken his neck, and Ari came out to do a healing ceremony with him. And I told Ari I'd cleaned all this stuff up, and I got on the plane, and I said, okay, today's a good day to die. I don't care if it goes down or not. And I discovered that I wasn't afraid of flying. And I told Ari that, and he said, that's great. Now you're free to live. And it was quite a nice revelation to me. So anyhow, our daughter, our youngest daughter, she called Louise yesterday, and she said, and I don't know if she'd ever heard me tell this story or not, but in any case, she said to Louise said, what was your moment when you were the most afraid getting out of that airplane? She says, when we first climbed out of the airplane before we dropped out of 10,000 feet. She said, but I told myself today's a good day to die. And the fear went away. And that's such a great point. Anyhow, Andy in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Tom. How are you?
Just great. What's up?
I got a real problem with what you were talking about as Americans. Nobody even talks about the fact that we tortured these two children until you said something.
Yeah, well, no, it was in the news, and it was in the news a couple of times, and it's been the result, and it's been discussed in congressional testimony. But by and large, just like, and Andy, it sounds like you're on a speakerphone there, just like we don't show the pictures of the dead bodies in Iraq, we don't talk about the things that we've done. But we will certainly talk about the nasty stuff that Russia has done, even though South Ossetia was invaded by Shakhavili in the first place, by Georgia in the first place, and perhaps as many as 1,000 people died in that invasion. I mean, it's like, you know, who pulled the trigger first? It looks like Georgia pulled the trigger first. And the Russians are very much in Russia playing this as, oh, we're the victims. We're defending our friends in South Ossetia. And the Georgians are saying, oh, no, we're the victims. And John McCain is trying to make this into a campaign issue. And frankly, I think it has blindsided the Obama campaign, and it's going to be a problem for them. So anyhow, we'll see how all this shakes out. Carrie in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Carrie.
Hi, Tom.
Yeah.
Listen, I'm calling about the woman who called objecting to the video that was put out by the Oregon Planned Parenthood affiliate.
Yeah.
And she claimed that video was paid for with federal funds, with taxpayer dollars, specifically Title X funds, I guess. And her basic premise was that taxpayer dollars shouldn't go to this sort of video. And
right.
Then she said that if it wasn't funded by taxpayer dollars, that she wouldn't object to the video.
Right.
So my question is, do we know that that was paid for by...
I talked with the folks from that particular Planned Parenthood. And
yeah.
The number of federal dollars that they get does not even cover all the federally, I don't know if it's mandated, authorized services that they provide.
Exactly.
And they get a whole bunch of donations that cover the rest of their services, plus things like this video. In my opinion, the problem, and this I think was just a strategic mistake that was made on their part, is they should have had a separate checking account that was only funded by contributions, out of which the checks were written for this website. I think that you know, just would have been a politically smart thing to do, and they didn't do that. They commingled all the funds, and so they can't say that no federal dollars were spent on this. And that's, you know, that's a weak point. I mean, you have to anticipate. Carrie, thanks for the call. You have to anticipate these kind of attacks. You have to know that the crazies are going to come after you, or crazies is perhaps too strong a word, but the people who are opposed to what you're doing are going to come after you, and you got to get ready for it. Coming up next, is gambling illegal, or should it be illegal? Is it immoral? Is it destructive? What are we going to do about that? Is it going to become an issue in the campaign?
This is Tom Hartman. Is Tom Hartman.
So going through the list of election issues and all the so-called social issues, there's one that's kind of flying under the radar, but it's actually been a big deal when it comes to funding. Ralph Reed and Jack Abramoff and John McCain actually was involved in this thing. In fact, he used his senatorial prerogative to get his own participation in it excised from a congressional report that a committee he was on did about the Abramoff affair. But basically, they had been playing Indian tribes off against each other and all these kinds of things, because gambling is illegal in many states, in most states, but it's not on an Indian territory, Native American territory, which is considered, you know, a separate nation. And so that kind of loophole in the law has allowed this thing to happen, and so there's a lot of money at stake. And Les Bernal is with me. Am I pronouncing it right, Les?
You are.
Okay, Les Bernal, and he is the executive director of StopPredatoryGambling.org. And Les, I'll bet you $5 you and I agree that this whole thing with Rove and Abramoff is a bad deal.
Oh, I think it's a bad deal. But
you take that bet.
But in fairness, I mean, you and I think are pretty much on the same side of the political spectrum. But
yeah.
So obviously, you know, the Republicans have had some serious issues with Abramoff and so forth and the gambling issue. But to be perfectly honest, it's really in large part been the political left in this country that's been behind this massive push behind what I describe as predatory gambling, this idea of raising government revenues through more sophisticated gambling products like electronic gambling machines, $50 scratch tickets, and so forth.
Yeah. I think, broadly speaking, I don't disagree with you that it's a tragedy that we have to have state lotteries to pay for education. It's absurd. It's obscene. I don't think that the government should be promoting gambling or even the idea of gambling. So I suspect in that realm we agree. However, why not simply make this, you know, totally decriminalize gambling? This is a behavior that there's no physical basis for addiction, unlike drugs. I mean, you can at least build a case, I suppose, for making heroin illegal because you can demonstrate physical addiction or tobacco. But there's no physical thing here. This is purely psychological.
Apologize for interrupting, but actually that's not accurate. The impact on the brain when you're doing big time gambling like slot machines, scratch tickets, and so forth, and it's actually been mapped out by some psychologists at Mass General Hospital as well as several other kind of research institutions around the country, that the impact on the brain is similar to taking a hit of cocaine. And that's why these machines, particularly electronic gambling machines and scratch tickets, are the biggest sellers in the gambling trade.
Well, what you're describing is that some people get a big rush off this. They get an adrenaline high, but we get the same thing when we go to see a movie.
True, but the argument is before.
So should we ban movies?
But the argument could be, not everyone who takes cocaine gets addicted either.
Well, and not everybody who goes to a movie gets addicted to movies, but there is a small subset of people who actually are. And I would submit to you that the vast majority of people who gamble do so for entertainment. I mean, for years and years, my mom and dad used to go to there's an Indian casino in near Lansing up north of there. And, mom would have a roll of nickels and it would be good for about 3 hours and, maybe a couple of rolls of nickels. She'd go through $10, $12, $15. And they can, as long as they could keep it below $5 an hour, they thought it was good entertainment.
And that's the difference, I think. People like your mom and dad aren't the money makers for the gambling trade. They make 80% of their revenues off 20% of the gamblers. So it's the problem gamblers who are the money makers. And you brought up the analogy of movies. Well, Steven Spielberg watches the movies he makes. This is the only product that people describe as entertainment where the people who own it and promote it don't play it. And they're proud about that. And why is that? Why don't the Gary Lovemans at Harris and many of our public officials who promote gambling as a way to fund government, why don't they play the product that they promote and sell?
Well, first of all, I don't know that all of them don't. I'm guessing that some of them probably proudly don't. But secondly, they're also in an industry that is incredibly careful about not becoming corrupted. And it's just the same reason. Why is it that in professional sports, even though it's legal in some places to gamble on professional sports, if you're with a professional sports team, you get nailed for gambling on it? I mean,
respectfully, the reason why they don't play is less because of the corruption. I mean, what you just brought up, you started this conversation with the Abramoff scandal. I mean, there's
right.
hardly any issue in this country that's more scandalous and brings more corruption to government than predatory gambling. But the reason why these guys don't play is because they know it's a sucker's bet. And that's why, you know, you have very prominent people on the left now, guys like Taylor Branch, who, as you know, is a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian for his book Parting the Waters on the Civil Rights Movement, has come out to say that, you know, that predatory gambling, particularly sponsored by the state, is, you know, defies the very essence of equal citizenship.
It's a sucker's bet if you think that this is a way to earn a living. It's a sucker's bet if you think that this is a way to make money. It is not a sucker's bet. It's not even, I mean, there's not even sucker and bet in the equation if it's viewed as entertainment. And if we, I mean, why not just say that, I mean, what's wrong with saying that the ills that are associated with this are really associated with the prohibition? and instead just say, you know, we're not going to have laws against gambling in the United States anymore. And let's get the government out of the business of gambling. If they want to build a school, they can raise taxes and, you know, just let, like in Holland, you can walk into a restaurant and there's a little, you know, game machine in the back you can play if you want.
Well, then why don't we use that same line of thinking when we're talking about regulating credit cards or, you know, predatory lending practices? I mean, banks can't go out and lend any kind of loans they want to people. I mean, they've tried to do that in the last few years, and they've got a huge subprime mortgage crisis.
Banking is not entertainment. If I'm getting a mortgage for my home, this is a huge investment. We're talking about, you know, all of my money. That's not entertainment.
Well, we keep describing it as entertainment, but here's my point again. You describe this as entertainment, and that's kind of the industry's talking points for the gambling trade.
Well, I'd say the same is true of alcohol, and we have to acknowledge there's a real problem with alcohol as well.
Robert Mondavi drank the wine he made, okay? You know, you talk about going to a restaurant. You know, David Thomas of Wendy's eats the hamburgers he makes. All these guys
got a heart attack from them.
We describe this product as entertainment under the guise of entertainment, but the truth is what we've done is we've trapped, you know, and you being on the left like myself, like what we've done is trapped millions of Americans in a cycle of debt and poverty because we've told people 20% of Americans, 21% of Americans think the best way to save for retirement is to play the lottery. I mean, can you believe that? So essentially what we've done is...
Which is stupid, and it's because government has been reduced to, you know, the Grover Norquist of the world have been successful in reducing government to the size where they're drowning in the bathtub, and people get it that, you know, the cons are destroying Social Security, they're destroying the pensions that people used to have. I mean, right across the board, they're freaked out, and then they see these ads for the lottery. Oh, that must be a wonderful thing. That's all wrong.
You and I agree on that. But do you really think
that by making gambling illegal, you're going to do anything other than drive it underground, and then you're going to end up with basically the mob running the business again?
Are you suggesting that more people are gambling today than ever before due to the fact that governments promoted this product as a way to raise money and as a way to fund government? So that the idea that, you know, millions of hundreds of millions of Americans were gambling when the mob ran it, I mean, that's absurd. I mean, yeah, gambling is in every convenience store today across this country. You know, big time scratch tickets. You got, you know, Americans that live within 2 hours of casinos now across the country. You know, and the idea that we're getting tourist money. I mean, this is
I get this, and we agree that the government should not be in the gambling business. I'm right there with you. But I don't see how you're going to stop people from wanting to gamble, and all by having these narrow narrowly circumscribing where people can gamble and where they can't. All we're doing is we're essentially creating, you know, federally or state defined monopolies.
Yeah.
You know, on Indian tribes, Indian reservations, and in Las Vegas.
I see where you're getting hung up here, and I think let me take a minute just try to articulate.
We only have a minute left.
Sure. The whole idea of stoppredatorygambling.org is there's a difference between predatory gambling and what we're talking. You're talking about people are going to gamble. Of course, people are going to play Friday night poker games. They're going to do Super Bowl office pools. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about doing it as a business for profit, and that's the major difference here. And we have allowed our countries in partnership with the gambling trade, and we've trapped. You know, the Democratic Party was supposed to represent working people, and it's working people who are playing these products, and really we're playing these guys for suckers.
So you want to make illegal all gambling in the United States?
I want to do forms of predatory gambling where people are doing it. The marketing practices.
You want to stop all commercial gambling?
I think before we stop stopping anything, let's have some public hearings across this country on the product itself. Why aren't the people that own it and promote it, why don't they play it? You know, you have an MIT professor who has declared the electronic gambling machines as the high-tech equivalent of loaded dice.
Yeah, you know? Interesting. Okay, Les Burnell, he's the executive director of StopPredatoryGambling.org. Thanks, Les, for the conversation.
Tom, thank you.
Thought-provoking. And I'll bet our listeners learn something. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
This is Tom Hartman.
Yeah. The festival was over and the boys were all planning for a fall. The cavalry was quiet except for the drilling in the wall. The curfew had been lifted and the gambling wheel shut down. Anyone with any sense had already left town. He was standing in the doorway looking like the Jack of Hearts.
So speaking of gambling, John McCain would like you to do that with your Social Security dollars. Let us remember, Social Security is an insurance program. An insurance program is, by definition, where you take a large number of people, a small number of whom are going to face a very terrible risk, and you distribute that very terrible risk for that small number of people over a very large base of people. Or even a large base of people, all of whom will experience a terrible risk. But by evening it out, you can kind of even out the pay. Like with life insurance, everybody dies, right? If everybody has life insurance, everybody's eventually going to collect on it. But over the years, everybody pays in. The money can be used, invested or saved or pooled fundamentally and increase in value and people get covered. I mean, the insurance companies invest their money. So as does the Social Security Administration, by the way. So, although they just don't do it in the marketplace, thank God. But John McCain wants us to gamble with our money. He wants us to be putting our money in the stock market, which is a legalized form of gambling for many people, and probably every bit as addictive for those few people who are easily addicted to gambling. And yes, there are gambling addicts out there. I'm the first to acknowledge it. John McCain wants us to do that with our Social Security money. In 2004. McCain came out. He was asked, should privatizing Social Security be a priority? He said, without privatization, I don't see how you can possibly, over time, make sure that young Americans are able to receive Social Security benefits. In 2005, while appearing with President Bush in Tucson, Arizona, McCain said, quote, private savings accounts work. They've been proven to work not only in America, but all over the world, and we ought to really strongly support it, end quote. Which, by the way, is nonsense. When Chile had to privatize their Social Security system as a part of the terms to get a loan from, I believe it was the World Bank, it might have been the IMF. You know, they're requiring countries now to buy into this neoliberal conservative economic nonsense. It destroyed their Social Security system. In 2005, he was campaigning for Bush's Social Security privatization program. McCain has been especially, this is from the Washington Post, McCain has been especially supportive of his one-time rival, appearing with Bush at three events over the past 2 days, trying to prod Democrats into negotiations to include private accounts and a plan to revamp Social Security. In 2008, earlier this year, he said, and this is quoting John McCain, as part of Social Security reform, I believe that private savings accounts are a part of it along the lines of what President Bush proposed. Let us keep in mind that back in 1977, when Bush ran for Congress from Texas for the House of Representatives unsuccessfully, the cornerstone of his campaign was privatizing Social Security. Today is the 73rd anniversary of Social Security. In 73 years, they have never failed to write a check. Let's keep also in mind that fully a third of the beneficiaries of Social Security are those people who are really and truly in a crisis, literally widows, orphans, and the disabled. This is an insurance program, and it's an insurance program against old age poverty. It's an insurance. I mean, back in the Great Depression, back in the day when Social Security was first created, one of the leading causes of death among elderly people in the United States in the North was freezing in the winter, and in the South was diseases associated with heat and with poverty, with lack of food, and people literally were starving, and so Social Security was insurance against poverty for old age, insurance for children against their parents being killed. Literally orphans insurance, insurance for women against their husbands being killed if that person was the sole survivor, let them get back on their feet, particularly if they're raising a family, or vice versa for that matter, a man if the woman was the breadwinner, although, you know, back when it was created, it was far more rare. And insurance against things like my friend Michael, who broke his neck and is paralyzed from the neck down. Insurance for him. I mean, Michael's literally living on Social Security. If he had had to pay into a private account throughout his working life and was now living on that now, he'd probably be dead because he wouldn't be able to afford the care. And McCain wants to privatize this thing. And the Bush-McCain Social Security privatization plan not only is going to blow a hole in the federal budget, not only is going to hand hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars in profits over the next 20, 30, 40 years over to the financial institutions in this country that managed with Phil Graham's help back in 1999 and 2000 to get the Glass-Steagall Act rolled back so that banks could get into the gambling business, basically, the investment business. And we're seeing right now how well that worked out. But now he wants to do this with Social Security. And this could cost Americans at least $1 trillion, just as the transitional costs, and over $5 trillion over 20 years. And A, where is a lot of that money going to end up? In the hands of the brokers, in the hands of the bankers, in the hands of the people who are, quote, investing our dollars, end quote. And B, what happens when the market goes down? What, are we going to have to pick and choose when we, you know, because markets are cyclical. They do go up and they do go down. We're going to have to pick and choose when to retire? And what about those of us who just frankly don't have the time or the knowledge to know how to do good investing? Well, sorry, you're going to lose out. And this is crazy, privatizing Social Security. But it's part of this campaign of these guys of rolling back the New Deal. It's all about
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Call him now at 866-303-2270.
Every man's a king, every house a kingdom. It's like Joe McCarthy was a acting president. Everything's a-okay in the USA, in the good old USA.
34 minutes past the hour of Tom Hartman program, brought to you in part by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors, and in part by the Teamsters, fighting to pass the Employee Free Choice Act. You can find out more about that over at teamster.org. A quick heads up, this weekend I'll be in Seattle speaking at a round table with a whole bunch of great talk show hosts, 6:30 to 7:30, Seattle Center Exhibition Hall. I'll be in Denver on August 26th at 6 p.m. We're doing a book signing of Borders Books in Lone Tree, Colorado at the Park Meadows Mall. You can find out information about that at the website of am760.net, Colorado's Progressive Talk, am760. On September 2nd, the Voice of Minnesota, am950, KTNF, invites you to a party for change. Bill Press, Stephanie Miller, Jim Ward, Chris Lavoie, Ed Schultz, me, John Elliott, and Bill Press and I will be doing a book signing, Black Bear Crossing on the Lake, located at the historic Como Lakeside Pavilion. So. Our Silvio Berlusconi alert for the day. Silvio Berlusconi, the small-time crook and entrepreneur who bought a couple of radio stations, and then a few television stations, and then a radio network, and then a TV network, and then another radio network, and then a few newspapers, and ended up owning about 95% of all the media in Italy, and then ran for prime minister, and surprise, he won! Anyway, when he ran for re-election, the citizens of Naples, who were having a garbage problem because their garbage workers were on strike, as I recall, said if he was elected and he would solve the rotting garbage problem, they would nominate him for sainthood. Well, he called out the army. Amazing what you can do with the army. And the garbage is gone, and so now they're talking about sainthood for Berlusconi. Believe it or not, Saint Silvio. Amazing. Rush Limbaugh says, I tell people don't kill all the liberals. Leave enough so we can have two on every campus, living fossils. So we'll never forget what these people stood for. Senator Phil Graham said, we're going to keep building the party until we're hunting Democrats with dogs. Congressman James Hansen about Bill Clinton. He says, impeach the guy, get rid of him, censure him, assassinate him. In the National Review, John Derbyshire, the conservative writer, said that because Chelsea Clinton had the taint, she should, quote, be killed, end quote. Ann Coulter, quote, we need to execute people like John Walker in order to physically intimidate liberals by making them realize that they can be killed, too. She also said of Tim McVeigh, my only regret with Timothy McVeigh is that he did not go to the New York Times building. Bill O'Reilly.
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Yeah. Glenn Beck talking about, you know, how he could conceivably kill Michael Moore with his bare hands. I mean, it goes on and on and on. I mean, this, in fact, he says, I could kill him myself. Or if I would need to hire somebody to do it, no, I think I could. I think he could just be looking me in the eye, you know, and I could just be choking the life out of him. Is this wrong? Well, Glenn, yeah, it is. Mel Gibson on Frank Rich, the liberal columnist for the New York Times. He says, I want to kill him. I want his entrails on a stick. I want to kill his dog. And on it goes. I mean, this meme, and then, you know, 2 weeks ago, we see a guy who's got Sean Hannity's and Rush Limbaugh's and Michael Savage's books on his bookshelf at home, walks into a Unitarian church and murders a couple of people. And yesterday, the head of the Arkansas Democratic Party, Bill Guatney, was assassinated. I mean, let's use the A word. He was assassinated. Open season on Democrats. You know, I'm sorry, Rush. I just don't find it so funny. I find it, frankly, tragic. I mean, this, to have these guys out there promoting this idea that, you know, that killing is an appropriate thing, or even frankly to use the phrase, I mean, it's just.
Yeah, I am not perfect. If I were, I wouldn't really bother to ask any questions. I mean, I guess I could just stay out of trouble by asking clearly scripted questions to guests who won't disagree, but that would kind of be planned and kind of a planned perfection that breeds arrogance that is far more dangerous than being a dope like me who says the wrong thing from time to time. If I'm going to be shut down for that, well, it will likely be because of an intolerant ideologue like Keith Olbermann. The very idea smacks of the same McCarthyism Murrow fought so valiantly against. Hey, Keith, you're not saving the world's democracy. You're killing it, my friend.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, even the use of this language, it's just, it is so, so wrong. By the way, I wanted to share with you just a quickie. This from today's Financial Times. John Gapper writing about this. If you go over to networkadvertising.org, you can opt out for many of the cookies. And you can actually find out what cookies are on your computer that are continuously tracking every single website that you go to. And he's got a great piece on web privacy in today's Financial Times. But the website is networkadvertising.org. And it's sort of, you know, the industry's way of saying, well, you know, we'll let you out if you'll let us keep on. You know, it's sort of their justification for doing this. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Sean in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, listen, thank you very much for your program, Tom. I mean, the brain does come with a body. In your case, I'm so pleased.
Thanks, Sean. What's your point?
I wanted to say is that most people don't realize that you were talking about Social Security earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That a lot of the third world countries, you see these very large families living under one roof.
Yeah.
And same thing in other countries, and that's due to the fact that in their countries, when people are no longer able to work, they have to live with the youngsters because they have no safety net.
Right.
So here we are. These people are trying to kill Social Security, and I mean, so what happens then?
Right, and
imagine the catastrophic consequences of having no Social Security for these people, and when they're talking about making it as an investment thing so you can have the same guys from Enron to manipulate the money, are you kidding me? These people are really criminals, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it really is, Sean. Thank you very much for the call. But here's, by the way, back on the theme of killing liberals, Ann Coulter.
So I've learned my lesson. If I'm going to say anything about John Edwards in the future, I'll just wish he had been killed in a terrorist assassination plot.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott in Kaiser, Oregon. Hey, Scott.
Hey there, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Regular
sure.
listener. Can't say that I always agree with what you have to say, but it's always interesting listening. Today, it's funny, I mean, hearing so many topics that actually need attention, but I'll try to keep my comments focused on just a couple real quick ones here. One of the earlier folks you were talking about, the sex ed training stuff, the stuff I find really frustrating there is when I hear people suggesting willful ignorance as a way to kind of promote their moral values versus, a more collective way of thinking. That just doesn't make sense to me. But what really got me fired up this morning was actually listening to your morning show a little bit, and what I guess I'll call the topic of good enough spending of our public funds. And I just see way too much what I'll call status and rampant, we need the latest, put in X, whatever it is, spending. And just a couple of quick examples, in the town I used to live in, they needed a new fire station. And so instead of building a modest building to put the fire trucks in, they spent about 3 to 4X what that would have been to have the latest showpiece brick building with fancy art and everything else like that.
Yeah.
And so it's one of those things.
You know, Scott, the flip side of that, though, is that you've got a lot of buildings that back in the 20s and 30s and 40s were built as the latest technology, the greatest technology, and they're still around 40, 50 years later. I mean, there's something to be said for doing things right if you're going to do them.
I'm definitely not suggesting not doing it right, but what I think we're missing too much in the way that we look at our public spending, it's more based on status. I mean, I live in Oregon, and every time I drive by the state building there and I see the big gold statue and all that kind of stuff, so that shows that we have wealth and we can spend. But how many school books would have that guy who stands on top of the state building bought for us?
Yeah. Scott, I'm sorry. I'm just going to respectfully disagree with you and say that, if you want to see spending for status, go look at corporate headquarters. Look at the corporate jets. Look at the limousines that the executives are riding around in. You won't find any of that in government. Outside of the George Bush White House, what you'll find is that most government buildings are quite modest. Most government facilities are quite modest. And tragically, a lot of our schools are actually falling apart. And, all over this country, our infrastructure is falling apart, because conservatives have been defunding this government consistently straight through in a very, very destructive way. I see we've got a call here, Jeff in Austria. Jeff, I'm going to pick you up as soon as I get back from the break. I'm sorry I didn't catch that we had an international caller earlier. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit us online at hartmanradio.com.
And I'm taking my country back. Been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So I'm taking my country back.
Yes, indeed, my friends, taking our country back, one congressional district at a time. Debbie Cook is running for Congress in California's 46th Congressional District. Her website, Debbie Cook, D-E-B-B-I-E, Cook, C-O-O-K, forforcongress.com. And Debbie, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
You are the, thank you. You are the mayor of Huntington Beach, California, an activist, a mom, a sports enthusiast, and you're running against Dana Rohrabacher?
Yes.
That's, he's, well, he's been a very effective publicity hound, shall we say, over the last few years. What, tell us about the race.
Well, yes, you're right. I'm running against a 20-year incumbent who I characterize as a bench warmer, maybe somebody who heckles from the sidelines, but he's actually achieved nothing for the district.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's time to, I think 20 years is enough time for anyone to demonstrate that they can achieve results. And he has not done that, and I would like to take his place.
Great. And let's talk about the issues that are facing California and the United States that you would be taking on, Debbie Cook. Debbie Cook, D-E-B-B-I-E, Cook, C-O-O-K, for Congress.com. This, by the way, this is how we win back Congress, is helping these individual progressives who are out there running for office get over to Debbie Cook's website and help her out a bit. Debbie, what would you be doing in Congress different from Dana Rohrabacher?
Well, my expertise is actually in energy, although I worked a lot on the environment in Orange County, on coastal issues, water quality issues, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to take my passion for the environment and turn it toward energy. I think we have a very unsophisticated view of energy, and I think I could bring a lot of realistic proposals to Congress and try to achieve some.
For example?
Well, you know, we focus so much on offshore drilling, and we're not going to drill our way out of this. We've heard that line over and over again. But the reality is that every time we vote for drilling, we're voting against working on the technologies that we need to actually transition to a sustainable future.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to put an incredible amount of energy and funding into renewables. All kinds of renewables, including the research and development that should have been done. We should have funded it appropriately 20 years ago, or back when Jimmy Carter alerted us to this problem with oil.
Right.
And because we have not done that, we have refused to change our CAFE standards. It means that the rest of the world got ahead of us. So we got behind in the energy race. China and Europe and all of these nations are now going full steam ahead in renewables, and we have a lot to do to catch up to that.
You know, there have really been two points in the 20th century or the 20th and 21st century, in recent history, where there were very, very clear wake-up calls, the first being the Middle East oil crisis in the early 70s, and Jimmy Carter responded to that and actually passed some very good legislation, you know, the Solar Bank and the solarization program around the country and energy tax credits and lowering speed limits and things. All of that was undone when Ronald Reagan came into office when he replaced him. And 9/11. 9/11 was could have been that moment in time when, had we had a decent and competent president, could have said, you know, we can track this right back to our addiction to oil and our involvement in the Middle East, and it is now time for us to get off that addiction to oil and use the shock and horror and energy associated with, human, you know, inertia, I suppose, momentum, associated with that to come up with some new programs. And in both cases, we failed.
Yeah, we're a lot of wars around the world are going on right now. They're really just resource wars.
Yeah.
And so the more we can bring our own, we create the energy here at home, we won't be having to fight all these resource wars around the world. So it's good for America. It's really green. Really is the new red, white, and blue. And to create the workforce that will put solar panels on homes and deliver the services that people are going to need to insulate their homes. To put in, new windows and all of those kinds of jobs. That's a huge market. We are behind Germany. Germany has more green jobs than America does, and they're one-fifth our size.
Mm.
So there's a huge amount of opportunity here that we need to get on board with.
You mean in absolute numbers? They have more green jobs than we do?
Yes, they
not
have
per capita?
250,000 green jobs in Germany, 194,000 in the United States.
Wow.
That's according to Roger Bezdek, who's done a lot of work for the Department of Energy.
No, I believe it, because they've got a very aggressive program to have everybody put a solar panel on their roof.
Yeah.
So there's people doing that. I mean, they've built two nuclear power plants worth of energy from home solar power that's feeding back into the grid. We're talking with Debbie Cook, the mayor of Huntington Beach, California, running against Dana Rohrabacher for the 46th Congressional District of California. And her website, Debbie, D-E-B-B-I-E, Cook, C-O-O-K, for forcongress.com, DebbieCookForCongress.com. Debbie, other in the last minute or two here that we have, the other points that significantly differentiate you from your opponent, from Dana Rohrabacher.
Well, I've been really active on coastal and water quality issues. I was instrumental in eliminating the sewage waiver that the Orange County Sanitation District has. He supported continuing the dumping of partially treated sewage. But because we embraced the further treatment, we then opened up the door to recycle that water and actually turn something that we were throwing away into something that we can reuse. And so the Orange County Water District then teamed up with the Sanitation District. It would not have happened if we had not moved away from this, you know, 19th century, kind of technology. Just like oil is a 19th century technology, we need to move ahead to something that will solve our 21st century problems.
Yeah.
And so we were able to do that because we cleaned up the water that we were dumping in the ocean. I've also been very active in preserving the Bolsa Chica, the little open space that is left, preserving our access to beaches and parks and that sort of thing. So we differ substantially. Of course, Dana Rohrabacher also denies climate change, and we couldn't be more of a stark.
You're kidding. He's an absolute denier?
He's a
global warming denier.
He believes that it's a hoax. It's a myth.
It's a hoax.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, well, Debbie Cook for Congress, D-E-B-B-I-E-C-O-O-K, DebbieCookForCongress.com is the website. And get over there and check. It is .com, right, Debbie?
Yes, thank you.
Great.
Thank
get
you for
over
the
there
work
and check
you're
out.
Doing.
You're welcome, and thank you for the work you're doing.
Okay.
It's great.
Bye-bye.
57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
It was absolutely fascinating to watch the coverage of this whole dust-up in Georgia. CNN was just reporting about how they've finally got reporters into Skin Valley, I believe is how it's pronounced, the capital city of South Ossetia. And this is where a week ago the Georgian army went in and basically took down this town. This is in a part of Georgia that since 1993, since you know essentially when Georgia was given independence, has opted to be independent of Georgia, and that independence has been largely acknowledged. It's not full independence. They haven't declared themselves a state or a nation or anything like that. But so the president of Georgia, Mikhail Saakashvili, invaded the city, and it looks like at least 1,000 civilians were killed in this invasion. The Russians went in and took it back and then continued pushing south into Georgia and said, okay, now you did wrong, we're going to spank you, basically, and they've taken a couple of cities. But in the entire 5 minutes of CNN reporting on this, They talked about this is where the fighting began. They never mentioned the fact that the city in South Ossetia was invaded by the Georgians. It was never mentioned. In fact, watching it and listening to the way that they were phrasing things, you would think that maybe the Russians had first invaded that city. I mean, I just find it so fascinating how the news media is playing this whole thing. It's like, let's just be sure to make this bad Russians and good, American allies, Saakashvili, even if the guy screwed up, even if he did a terrible thing, you know, it's just going to be bad. And who is the presidential candidate whose top foreign policy advisor took $800,000 in this country for lobbying? And who is using this every single day out there constantly as a campaign device, as a campaign tool? John McCain, and has got his surrogates all over TV going, oh, yeah, John McCain, he knows how to take on the Russians, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I am, you know, I'm generally not inclined to what some folks describe as conspiracy theories, but I really am coming to the conclusion that this is the October surprise. This is the Republicans' way. I don't think the president of Georgia would have taken such a potentially suicidal move, taking on the Russians like this, if he hadn't been told, at least with a wink and a nod, just like Saddam Hussein wouldn't have invaded Kuwait, if April Gillespie hadn't told him what James Baker said, which was, we're going to consider that an internal matter if you do that, between you and them. That's, you know, the Kuwait used to be your 42nd district or whatever it was, 22nd state, I forget the number. And, you know, just go ahead. And so he does, and now George Herbert Walker Bush gets to be a war hero. And so with a wink and a nod to Saakashvili, we say, yeah, sure, you know, or maybe it's just Randy Shuneman. I mean, the guy was part of the Project for a New America Century. He was the leader of the Liberate Iraq group in 2000. He was, here's a guy who was, you know, gung-ho for Iraq when that was politically useful for the Republicans. You'll recall, you know, why did George Bush invade Iraq? Well, Cindy Sheehan testifying before Congress.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalists, and longtime Bush family friend, Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, one of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
And there you have it. You know, George Bush saying in 1999 that he would invade Iraq because he would get political capital from it. And keep in mind, this was something that in 2002 was being planned, was being used to turn the congressional elections in 2002, the threat of it. And the actuality of it was used throughout 2003. You know, they don't do October surprises in October anymore. Throughout 2003 and all of 2004 to flip the 2004 election. Color me paranoid, but I believe the time will prove me out. I really and truly believe that a year, two, 3 years from now, we will look back on this and you will be hearing the exact kind of things you're hearing right now about the Bush administration and Iraq. Oh, they forged the document. Oh, they encouraged Saddam Hussein to invade Iraq or Kuwait. I mean, that going back, you know, a couple of decades. Oh, they were trying to smuggle in weapons of mass destruction. Oh, they've got the head of Iraqi security was telling us before we invaded that there's nothing there. And we paid him $5 million for it, and we set him up in a safe house in Amman, Jordan, where he is to this day. Although our official policy is, oh, we're looking for this guy. He's the Jack of Clubs, you know, or the Jack of Diamonds. Meanwhile, at home, the thing that Americans, frankly, rather than, oh, let's get all hysterical about the Russians, the thing that Americans should be looking at is that, as Andrew Jacobovics writes for the Center for American Progress, it's 1930 all over again, a 55% increase in foreclosure activity July over July. This is like what we saw in the 1930s. And a tip of the hat to, I think it's Jim Schaefer, who sent me the tax tables from 1916 to today. This is absolutely fascinating. And you can just see how this thing got set up. In 1917, the top income tax rate on people making more than $2 million a year was 67%. In 1918, it went up to 77%. In 1919 through 1921, it was a 73%. Then in 22, you had, you know, the Republicans came in, took control. Wilson lost the election. And the tax rate dropped to 58%. And then in 1925, down to 25%. And then in 1929, Herbert Hoover got through a huge tax cut for the rich. He dropped the top income tax rate down to 25%, and the tax rate on capital gains went from 73% in 1919 to 12.5% in 1929. And what did it bring us? The Republican Great Depression. So finally, in 1936, Franklin Roosevelt gets the top rate on people earning more than $2 million a year back up to 78%, and the income tax rate on capital gains back up to 39%, and starts putting the economy back together. We start sliding out of the Great Depression. In World War II, 1945, the top rate goes up to 94%. That was, of course, during the war. And by 47, it's back down to 86.5% and stays in the 70s all the way up to 1982. Or up to 81, 82, Reagan. And you had the top rate on capital gains at 39%. And then Reagan drops it down to 28% for both earned income and capital gains. And boom, the beginning of 30 years of economic destruction. What it took them about 15 years leading up to the Great Depression to do the same thing with massive tax cuts for the rich. You end up with a very small number of mind-bogglingly wealthy people, a lot of speculation in the markets, the markets swinging all around crazily. And now we're seeing the exact same thing again. By the way, we're going to get Ravi Batra on tomorrow to talk about this stuff. But here on the 73rd anniversary of Social Security, as we see the absolute and utter failure of trickle-down economics, of conservative and neoconservative economic policies, the total and absolute failure of this stuff. And you see how, you know, twice in this nation's history, we have massively dropped income taxes on the very wealthy. In the 10 years leading up to the Republican Great Depression of 1929, and in the arguably 30 years leading up to right now, when I would argue we are at the very edge of another Great Depression, if not already in it. And yet you still have cons out there talking about the wonders of trickle-down economics and modifying Wikipedia pages and you know, the conventional wisdom of, oh, isn't it, you know, this is you cut taxes and you increase economic activity. No, sorry. You cut taxes on the very, very wealthy, and you cause them to build more factories in China. It's just the insanity of neoconservatism, neoliberalism, and now all the media wants to talk about Russia and, John Edwards? Give me a break. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Uncommon Sense from the Radical Middle. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. And Jake in Los Angeles. Hey, Jake, what's on your mind today? Jake? No Jake. Okay, Eva in San Francisco. What's on your mind today, Eva?
Hi, Mr. Hartman. This is Eva Hart, and I used to be in the Army. And I want to talk about Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Just some 4 points with it. In the past, I quit evil criminal jobs as a Christian, and I was doing my homework, and I discovered by Vanessa Devereaux, she talks about Social Security, and her book, The Government of a Free Nation, 63, in chapter, what happened is she states about Social Security, that it came about as a law in 1935 by Congress, that is like an annuity paid on an insurance policy, not charity. That it came about because local communities could not afford to take care of the people during the Depression.
Right.
And that, two more points, and I'd like you to explain the last one. The fourth point is guaranteed income to help prevent a depression, she says.
Yep.
And I'd like you to explain this point. The unemployed, aged, are not a burden, compassionately so, because of buying power. Can you explain that, Mr. Hartman?
The unemployed, I'm sorry?
She says the unemployed, the aged, elderly, are not a burden because of buying power by being on Social Security, welfare, and other programs.
Right, Right. Essentially, what she's saying is that if the elderly who are poor and are not working, if they're simply, you know, barely getting by or being fed by their families, basically, but have no ability to buy anything, then they're not stimulating the economy. If you give them a little extra money and let them buy a new, you know, a new pair of shoes from time to time, that's going to stimulate the economy. That's the point, is that that Social Security actually was one of the things that helped bring us out of the Great Depression by providing economic stimulus at that level. And I, you know, I think that was a good thing. Kim in Seattle. Hey, Kim.
Oh, hi there, Tom.
Hey, Kim, let me just put you on hold for a minute. I'm sorry, Kim, but Jeff in Linz, Austria has been online. And Jeff, I promised you a half hour ago I'd pick up your call. I'm sorry you're calling all the way from Europe. Jeff, you still there?
I'm here, Tom.
Yeah, so what's up?
So I just wanted to run the numbers game on the trade deficit. You'd been talking about that. And the $700 billion a year trade deficit that the U.S. is running actually has a much bigger impact on the economy than that. The economists call it the multiplier effect, where, like with George's stimulation package, he gives you $300 and you go to the restaurant, and then the restaurant buys more food, and so that $300 becomes like $600 worth of economic activity.
Right.
And the same with this $700 billion. What you're really taking out of the U.S. economy with that is more like about $1.4 trillion worth of activity, which is about 10% of the GDP.
Because we're having to borrow. Walk me through it. How does it work?
Well, when you put money into the economy and then you spend it, and then the person you spent it with.
Oh, I see. So it's just there's not a specific mechanism other than that the forward stimulus is not happening, and therefore, if you're going to calculate a backward stimulus, you have to calculate it based on the multiplier effect that isn't there.
Exactly. So it becomes somewhat of a divider effect in a way.
Right, right.
And so just by you've been talking about the tariffs, you could also fix it by requiring a barter trade policy with the countries that they're trading with.
Right.
So
there'd be parity, in other words, that if we buy, you know, $500 million or $500 billion worth of stuff from them, they have to buy $500 billion worth of stuff from us.
Exactly.
Yeah. And that was, you know, historically, tariffs were in part to do that, to try to achieve some sort of parity between countries and in trade. Excellent point, Jeff. Jeff, thank you so much for waiting so long. And what are you doing in Austria, by the way?
Well, I'm about to become unemployed. I am an American. We're going to try to stay here. I mean, the U.S. just doesn't look like a place to go back to right now. So,
yeah.
But the Europeans, they do protect their economies much much better than what we do back home, and as a result of that, you see it in every aspect of life here. People have a very good lifestyle here, and you know, people are comfortable. It's quite nice here, actually.
That's a fine thing, Jeff. Thank you very much for the call, and thanks for listening to us, Kim in Seattle. Kim, I'm sorry, we just have a minute left here. What's up?
Well, I'm just wondering, okay, based on what you believe is going to happen, the October surprise with, you know...
I think it's happening right now.
Yeah, and so how do you think Obama should most effectively respond to that to get us back to the issues that are affecting us right now?
Well, the problem is that this has become the issue, and this will become the issue, and these guys are going to demagogue Russia on this thing, and they're going to try and take us back to the Cold War, and I'm frankly not sure how he should respond to it. I've been really racking my brains on this thing. The obvious and simple thing, and probably the thing that the Democrats will suggest that he do, is that he join McCain in being, you know, the tough guy against Russia and take a nationalist position. But, you know, the other alternative would be to out Randy Shuneman and talk about, you know, the involvement of the McCain campaign in this thing. But I think that that's going to be subtle enough that it's going to fall on deaf ears for most of America. So it's going to be a really tough one, Kim. I see this as a no-win. This is again, the Republicans playing chess while the Democrats are playing checkers. Thanks for the call. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
As a young man, I found politics in the Bush's army door. And I got real good at dirty tricks. My name, sir, is Karl Rove. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me. 'Cause when your administration's gone, the right will kiss my knee. Well, I raised the right and squashed the left, the stars and bars you fly. Oh, excuse me, make that stars and stripes, the time how it speeds by. Oh, Dick Cheney, don't you cry for me.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Radio program. The True People's Radio. And just some downright strange stuff. Two thick black bear hair, or black hairs, rather, this Times Online, found on a mountainside in remote northwest India have prompted a new wave of speculation. Is it the Yeti, the Sasquatch, the abominable snowman, Bigfoot? They actually don't know. You've got a bunch of scientists flying over there to do DNA studies. Meanwhile, in Palo Alto, there's going to be a news conference. They claim they've found Bigfoot and that they've got DNA from him. And in Bhutan, as the older generation dies out, the younger generation is saying, there never was such a thing as a Yeti. Maybe, maybe not. Actually, I think what we need to do is we need to get the abominable snowman on the endangered species list. Let's start a campaign. That's what we need to do. Get on the endangered species list, the Bigfoot. What do you think, Christy Harvey, Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Christy, what do you think about it?
Well, I love the August news cycle. I was just thinking the other day, usually in August you get either the big shark attack stories or UFO sightings. And I hadn't seen anything like that yet, and so this morning I was delighted to see that there was a Bigfoot story.
Yep, there you go. There you go.
And on ABC, they actually are doing a study. They're promoting a scientific study done on beer goggles or whether or not people are more attractive after you've had a few pops.
Yeah.
Hello, August.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of big feet, in this case, in big mouths, a political strategist tied to Jack Abramoff is helping to raise money for John McCain.
Yes, and I'm actually excited about this because I haven't seen this guy around for a while, but Ralph Reed is back. Now, Ralph Reed, we remember, is the former director of the Christian Coalition, and he has just signed on to lead McCain's Victory 208 team, 2008 team, and he's out there soliciting donations for John McCain. And I love this because we've lost sight of Ralph Reed ever since he was so embroiled in the Jack Abramoff scandal.
Right, he was laundering money for Jack, wasn't he?
He was laundering money for Jack, and then he also got caught in some really sort of dubious email exchanges. My favorite of which was when he emailed Jack Abramoff, this is Ralph Reed, saying, I'm feeling sort of broke, quote, it's time for me to start humping for some corporate cash. Can you hook me up? So I guess he's finished humping for the corporate cash and is back into politics.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something that has been not a problem for John McCain. What's your take? I'm curious. I have been for several days now suggesting that the fact that Randy Shuneman was the head of, he was with PNAC, he was the head of the Free Iraq Committee, Iraq Liberation Committee in 2000. He's been a very, very, one of these activist Republicans who uses international crises as a way of forwarding Republican political agendas.
Right.
And that the Obama folks figured if the debate is about the economy, they win. If the debate is about Iraq, they win. But I don't think that they ever imagined that the debate would be about whether or not Russia was a bad power. And Shuneman takes $800,000 from Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, who was elected in 2003 at the age of 36, one of the youngest presidents in that region. They've got built the pipeline through there. This was one of the singular accomplishments of the Clinton administration. And these two regions, South Ossetia and Abkhazia, I haven't said it enough times that it's...
I was going to say, easy for you to say.
Yeah, Abkhazia. that he just, I mean, you know, while everybody's looking at the Olympics, he just goes and invades South Ossetia. Today it's coming out. It looks like, you know, maybe 1,000 people died in his invasion.
Right.
Our ally, Georgia, his invasion. The Russians say, hey, wait a minute, you can't do this. These people are aligned with us. We've been issuing them passports since 1993. We're going to defend our brothers and sisters here. And by the way, they drove all the way back into Georgia. But the media in the United States is playing this like Georgia good, Russia bad.
Right.
And I think this is putting Barack Obama in a box, and it is setting something, you know, John McCain up to have a whole brand new issue that, you know, this is the classic. He's the classic cold warrior. I mean, I think this is the October surprise. I don't think that Saakashvili would have invaded Georgia if he hadn't gotten a wink and a nod either from the Bush administration. Keep in mind, Karl Rove was out of the country when mm-hmm. he was supposed to be, when he was subpoenaed, and he was out of the country in that region. And what we don't know is exactly where he was in that region. I don't think that he would have done it without a wink and nod from either the administration or from John McCain.
Well, I think you're onto something there, and I think that it's also, you know, very interesting that it did happen, as you said, when it did, especially because people are distracted right now in America. Yeah. We're either on vacation or watching the Olympics, but no one is really in the mood to sit down and figure out what's going on, who's good, who's bad. People are in the mood to have maybe two or three quick facts thrown at them and then to dismiss the issue, which is it might be a different case had this happened at a different time.
Right.
But I do think that by not seizing upon the issue on the Obama campaign, they might be missing an opportunity for him to show some strength there. But
here's
also
the problem. If he seizes on it, if he to take a strong position,
right,
basically the only choice he would have is to either trash our ally, you know, Georgia, who
right.
I believe was in the wrong in this case, or trash Russia, who it looks to me like in this case, I mean, perhaps they were in the wrong by overreacting or overresponding or seeing this as an opportunity to take back a territory and a pipeline that they've been coveting. But nonetheless, trash Russia and play right into the neocons. I mean, this is right back to the committee for the present danger that Rumsfeld put together in 72.
Oh yeah, and it's a really tough position. Or there's the third option, which is not to say much of anything about it, in which case he sort of loses the opportunity to look like he knows better what he's doing on national security. It's a horrible position to be in.
Which is what he's doing, and that's as I said in the last segment. I think that the Republicans are playing chess, and the Democrats have been planning for a game of checkers.
I think that's a very good way to put it, but I don't think that it's a lost issue. I think, you know, it may backfire on Republicans a little bit since the country just isn't really connecting with this story.
Well, the way it'll backfire is if the media would even, they have not even been willing to talk about the fact.
Oh, yeah.
That McCain's top foreign policy advisor got $800,000 from this little country, Georgia, and has been, you know, that there's a possibility. I mean, this is being treated like it's a National Enquirer story about George and Laura breaking up or something. That there's, which the Enquirer is all over, by the way.
Right.
That there's a possibility that this could even be part of a campaign stunt by the McCain campaign.
Which, if that's the case, that just makes me sick to my stomach. But, you know, this Scheinman guy has been involved in so many different things. He's been, you know, sort of the behind-the-scenes guy on lots of different issues. And I know someone at Think Progress, our blog at the Center for American Progress Action Fund, is working on sort of a Venn diagram to show all of the different issues he's been involved with, plus he's involved with John McCain. So, you know, I'm not usually a conspiracy theorist, but I think that it really should, we should look into what his connection has been with all of this, definitely.
Yeah, yeah, amazing. Okay, charging for campaign signs?
This is a new one, and I thought you would think this was kind of funny because it's just so bizarre. But, you know, the yard signs that you put in
right.
your front yard, you know, I love Obama, I'm a McCain girl, or whatever it is.
Right.
Both campaigns have started to charge for them.
Well, this is something that the Obama campaign started early on, was charging for buttons and T-shirts and everything else, even charging just minimal amounts in order to build a database. I thought it was pretty smart.
It is, because it does allow most people, when they fork over, you know, their $7 for a sign, they also fork over their email address and things like that. And it's a way for them to get small donations from people who may not be able to afford, you know, giving $1,000 or something like that. But I don't know, Tom. It just, I see that it's a smart move, but I sort of liked the old days where even if you weren't going to give any money, you could still show your support in your front window. This sort of goes against that with me, but that's just me personally.
Well, there's also dirty tricks, though. I remember, you know, back in the day in Michigan that specifically, I knew of a Republican that would go to Democratic campaign headquarters and say, I'll take 100 signs.
Oh, exactly. No, yeah. Of course there's going to be dirty
and
tricks.
Straight
no matter
into
how
the trash.
You play it.
You know, straight into the trash. And so this would end that as well. Pervez Musharraf, what's going on right now with the president of Pakistan?
This is something to watch, because the news story has been that, of course, the Pakistani government has wants him to resign. And they said, if you don't resign, we're going to move forward with impeachment.
Right.
And he has said, no, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to stay. But there was
and he thought the army would back him up.
The army would back him up. But the news story that makes this even more interesting is the White House, it turns out, behind the scenes has quietly been saying to him, step down, step down, step down. It's time for you to go. So the fact that he's pushing back against his own government and the United States, which has seen him as an ally thus far, you know, in some modified circumstances, shows this is going to be an interesting story in the upcoming weeks.
I wonder if he's afraid that if he does step down, he'll be going the route of, you know, that he'll end up being prosecuted or something like that, you know, Pinochet kind of situation.
We'll see.
Very interesting. Christy Harvey with the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, ThinkProgress, MikeCheckRadio.org. Thanks, Christy.
Thanks a lot, Tom.
45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Truth in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Speaking of truth, the Washington Post today, Kerry Johnson writing in the Washington Post, the official position now of our government is that Bruce Ivins, the guy who conveniently committed suicide, was the guy who sent the anthrax to the only two men in the United States Senate who could have stopped the Patriot Act. Pat Leahy, whose committee it had to pass through, he was chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He could have stopped it in committee, and Tom Daschle, who was the Senate Majority Leader, who would have had to bring it up for a vote. He sent it to them, and then he committed suicide. Well, now the plot thickens. Federal investigators probing, this is from today's Washington Post, this is the lead, the first two sentences of the article. Federal investigators probing the deadly 2001 anthrax attacks recovered samples of human hair from a mailbox in Princeton, New Jersey. Now, this is the mailbox where these threat letters were sent. But the strands did not match the lead suspect in the case, according to sources briefed on the probe. FBI agents and U.S. Postal Service inspectors analyzed the data in an effort to place Fort Detrick, Maryland scientist Bruce Ivins at the mailbox from which bacteria-laden letters were sent to Senate offices and organizations, the sources said. The hair sample is one of many pieces of evidence over which researchers continue to puzzle in the case. And then they wrap the story up by saying nearly 7 years after the incident, investigators have come up dry in their efforts to find direct evidence to place Ivins at the Nassau Street mailbox in September and October of 2001. They can't even get this guy at the scene of the crime, and the evidence from the scene of the crime doesn't seem to have anything to do with this guy Ivins. I'm telling you, this was all about the Patriot Act. This is domestic terrorism inside the United States done by somebody who wanted to make sure that the Patriot Act, or some group who wanted to make sure that the Patriot Act was passed, and they got their wish. At the very least, this was some sort of bizarre or terrible false flag operation. I mean, this is bizarre. Joan in Missoula, Montana. Hey, Joan, thanks for calling 866-303-2270. What's up?
Well, I was going to comment on the Georgia and the Russia thing and what Senator Obama should do, and I think he should just go on hold and not be pressured by the Republicans to make a decision right now. I think he should tell them that I'll make my decision when I have all the information, and I'm not going to be pressured by you guys to be pushed into a corner just because.
Yeah, perhaps the strongest response is to say we only have one president of the United States at a time, and this is a time of international crisis, and so I am going to support the president in whatever he says or does because he's the president, and I wouldn't want to make his job any harder by playing politics with it, and then point out how John McCain is playing politics with it.
To form national policy.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much, Joan.
And I think Obama should stand up strong for not being pushed around by these guys. I think he needs to just tell them, hey, I'll do it in my time, and I don't need you to tell me how to run my campaigns.
Yeah, well said. Thank you, Joan. I appreciate it. Charles in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Charles.
Yeah, another thing is we need to find out what did Bush know and when did he know it. You know, here we have all these thousands of military advisors and Israel, too, in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And this thing, it takes place, this invasion in the South Ossetia. I mean, didn't any of our advisors know what was going on? And did they inform the president? Or?
Well, and I want to know what Karl Rove was doing in that region.
And what was Karl Rove doing over there?
And what's, you know, and this Randy Shuneman, I mean, you know, what's the deal with him? Just like with the anthrax, I mean, there's a lot of questions here that need to be answered that all kind of point to the politicization of stuff that shouldn't be political at all. This should have to do with national policy. But,
also, there's a big fat oil pipeline that runs across Georgia, too.
You betcha, and a lot of money associated with it. And it's in private, you know, it's a private company's oil line. Pipeline. I think British Petroleum owns the majority of it, and the bragging rights on that when it was put through there during the Clinton administration were, you know, this will let us get around the Russian control of all the oil in the region, and that may not last very much longer. I mean, we'll see. Charles, thanks a lot for the call.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to hear from you. Michael in Antioch, California, you wanted to go back to our earlier conversation?
Yes, Tom, how are you doing?
Just fine, thank you.
Rush Limbaugh was, Keith Olbermann actually had a clip of Rush Limbaugh on his show last night. I don't know if you saw it or not.
I did.
But Rush told what he thought, I guess, was a joke, excusing John Edwards for his indiscretions, and it was a tasteless, an awful joke about, not a joke at all, by the way, about Elizabeth Edwards. It was sexually based.
Right.
And listening to the woman you had on in the beginning, who was so appalled at the skits that are on
the Planned Parenthood would try to educate teenagers about sex. Yeah.
Right. I know Rush Limbaugh is against sex education, and he doesn't want anybody touching his tax dollars either. And
well, that's the issue for him. I don't think he cares. He's not a parent. I don't think he cares one way or another. But I think the bottom line for him is he's got his $400 million and he wants to keep every penny of it.
And
Michael, I want to let Stephanie have a comment, but your point is well taken. Stephanie in Oklahoma City, last half a minute here, Stephanie.
Yes, thank you for your show. I just wanted to say, can we not figure out how many dollars out of every $1,000 anybody pays in taxes actually go to a program like that?
Like the Planned Parenthood, it would be pennies or fractions of pennies out of
$1,000.
Yeah, it would be very, very little. Thank you, Stephanie. Tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie, Dr. Ravi Batra, Anything Goes Friday. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Get out there. Get active. Show up. Call your representative. Show up at a local party meeting. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com.